Good day,
and welcome to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, I'm glad you've decided to join us. Turn on the TV these days, and what do you see? Ad after ad after ad for political candidates, or sometimes against political candidates, who are going to be on the August 2nd primary ballot here in Michigan. And if you go to your mailbox almost any day of the week, if you're like me, you're pulling literature out, flyers, brochures, all kinds of things about candidates and their issues. Elections are getting more costly, and these commercials and these flyers, these things in our mailboxes, this is where we see a lot of that money being spent. In Michigan, 2018 saw the most expensive election season ever. At least $324 million were spent on a variety of campaigns, according to the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. And nationally, that trend appears to be the same. From 1998 to 2018, midterm election spending grew by more than $4 billion, according to OpenSecrets.org. And as I said, this year in Michigan does not seem to be any different. Governor Gretchen Whitmer raised more than $9 million in 2022 and has $15 million in the bank. This is as candidates like Representative Sri Thanadar, who's running for Congress, has spent millions on his own campaign, millions of his own money. The amount of money that is pouring into congressional and legislative races is absolutely staggering right now. And there are a lot of questions about where that money comes from, what that money's buying, and how voters can determine where that money comes from and what that money is buying. There's nothing illegal about the idea of money fueling campaigns or elections, but transparency means voters can understand what role the money is playing. And I don't think I'm alone in saying I don't think we have the kind of transparency we might want in our campaigns and our elections. That is where we want to begin the conversation today. What does it mean to have so much money sloshing around in Michigan campaigns? What kind of candidates get excluded from the process in this system, and how does it change our politics? And how does it alter the very issues that people talk about when they decide to run for office? Simon Schuster is someone who knows the world of campaign spending in Michigan really well. He's the former director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network and is now an investigative reporter at MLive covering politics. In addition to tracking candidates and representatives, he's still very much following the money, particularly during this primary season. Simon Schuster, welcome to Detroit Today.
Thank you so much for having me on, Stephen.
So Michigan gubernatorial candidates had to just now file their campaign reports. Let's start there. What did we learn from those who were running at the very top of the ticket here in Michigan?
Well, you know, I think that as myself and my colleagues are sort of profiling these gubernatorial candidates, we sort of characterize them and the lanes that they're trying to run in, the sort of candidates that they're trying to be and their pathways to victory. And I think that for myself and my colleagues, these campaign finance reports were really sort of an affirmation because they underscore and illustrate what these sort of avenues are. When you look at necessarily, for example, Tudor Dixon, who is a most recently a conservative commentator from Norton Shores. She's someone who's sort of tapping into conservative donor networks. When you look at her her filing, about half of her donors have given, or about half of her money is from donors who are giving the maximum contribution of $7,150. Now, her campaign is also kind of unconventional because it's something that is unique in sort of our post-Citizens United world. She's only raised about $1.6 million, which is not particularly impressive among this field, but at the same time, she has a super PAC that's supporting her. Can't coordinate with her campaign, but that has spent about $2 million on air, running advertisements in her favor. She attended a policy forum that they were hosting where they filmed her giving a speech and then filmed shots of her and her family on stage and then had a sit-down interview with her. And this has sort of been the basis for the footage that she's used or that has been used by this group in this campaign. Now, on the other hand, this is sort of in contrast to Kevin Rinke, who's a wealthy businessman from Bloomfield Hills. He's committed $10 million of his own money to this election. He's done not a lot of fundraising outside of that, and he's already spent about $5 million of that sum on this race. And he's, of course, attacking Dixon on the air with a significant number of ads for that. And then if you look at, by contrast, also Garrett Soldano, this is someone who is firmly in the populist lane. And so he's actually not gained much, you know, support from wealthy individuals donating at that maximum amount. He has instead sort of activated what he calls his grassroots army and is getting a ton of small dollar donations and has raised about $2 million and has actually applied and received public matching funds, which aren't necessarily very frequently used. They weren't in the last election, but he's utilizing them now to get about an extra $250,000. The other two candidates in this Republican primary, Ralph Brandt and Ryan Kelly, have raised considerably less money. And so it's sort of brought a distinction between these first three and the other two.
Yeah. And as I said in the open, Governor Whitmer has already raised more than $9 million this year, and she has $15 million in the bank. And I think that's that along with what's going on the Republican side are a good place to start thinking about the context here. How much money is being spent compared to years or even decades past, and whether this is getting out of control. And by that, I guess, I mean whether voters should be concerned about how much money is coming in, where it's coming from, and whether they are able to determine where that money comes from and what it's buying from people who would be public servants, people who want to be in government. Give us a sense of how big a deal all of this is.
Right. So I think it's incredibly important because, as you said, you know, 2018 was the most expensive state level election. And then 2020 became the most expensive election in Michigan's history immediately after. And I'd say it's pretty reasonable to estimate that we're on track for another record spending election, provided we can make up that $150 million or so that was spent in Michigan on the presidential election in 2020. Now, I think this is we're gearing up to see that happen again. The Democratic Governors Association has already reserved $20 million. That's a fifth of the total cost of the election in 2018. So, you know, to see that amount of advertising on airways is really important and a really big sign of what's to come. But I think it's also important to note that we can only peel back the curtain on this level of spending so far. A big, you know, as you noted, that there's a lot of campaign literature out there in people's mailboxes. I mean, that's from organizations where we can't track the funding. We don't really know how much is actually being spent there. We don't know, you know, how many millions of dollars of mail is heading into people's mailboxes. And so, you know, it's difficult to know exactly what the full cost of the elections are, but we can only sort of get an estimate.
Yeah. I'm talking with Simon Schuster. He is an investigative reporter who covers politics for MLive. He was previously the director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. And we're talking about campaign finance. We're talking about money in politics right now with just 6 days to go before the August 2nd primary. I think anywhere you live in the state of Michigan, and especially in Southeast Michigan, you are being bombarded with campaign ads on television and radio, with literature in your mailbox about candidates. all of this is a representation of the money that comes into these campaigns and gets spent on behalf of candidates and their issues. And it is it's a amount of money that has been growing over a significant period of time and to a scale that we haven't seen before. The races are extremely expensive, and lots of candidates are now just self-financing to the tune of millions and millions of dollars. We want to hear from you during this conversation as well. What do you make of the amount of money that is going into Michigan's political campaigns? What do you make of people self-funding their campaigns to the tune of millions and millions of dollars? What do you think should be the limits on campaign financial contributions? What do you think should be the rules about saying where you get money? So much of the money that is swirling around in these campaigns and around them is so-called dark money, money that we can't really trace the origin of. Is that okay? Or should we be doing more to make sure that voters know who's financing their candidates, who's paying to push certain issues before they cast their ballots? As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to the WDET Facebook page, put comments there. Or you can go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we'll work you into the conversation. Also want to hear from you if you think this is the way it should work, if you feel like you're getting more information than you ordinarily would from all the ads that are on TV and all the literature and stuff that's in your mailbox. Do you think that the equation of speech, political speech, and money is true, is something that makes sense, that we need to allow candidates to raise money to get their message out, to tell voters what they stand for and what they do if they were elected? Again, 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. You can also go to social media, to Twitter, and put comments there, and we'll work you into the conversation. Before we go to our listeners, Simon, I want to talk about dark money and how much it is playing a role in this particular cycle, and what the rules look like and what they could look like for making sure that there is transparency, that people are able to figure out who's behind the messages that we see and hear and read.
Right. So, you know, I think I want to take you back in time a little bit here, Stephen, to a 1976 Supreme Court decision called Buckley v. Valeo. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people discuss Citizens United in relation to dark money, but this one was particularly important because while this removed spending caps on our federal elections, in a footnote of this decision, there was one of the justices referred to 8 magic words, and that and essentially they were saying the government can regulate and force people to disclose money when these words are invoked, things like vote for, elect, support, cast your ballot for. And the way in which dark money has entered our elections is primarily through advertising. It can't coordinate with or give directly to campaigns, but what they run is the so-called issue ads. By avoiding what these 8 magic words, what's known as express advocacy, they engage in issue advocacy. And the primary way that this gets into our elections is through nonprofit corporations, 501c4 social welfare organizations. These nonprofits don't have to disclose their donors, and then they can spend unlimited amounts and take money from any source running advertisements that can say anything they want as long as they avoid express advocacy. So you'll notice a really good way to spot dark money in our elections is when you receive an ad that isn't telling you expressly to vote for somebody. And we can trace the names of these organizations, but if they're not reporting to the Federal Election Commission, we really don't know how much money they're spending. And unfortunately, these nonprofits don't have to even report how much they spend until more than a year after the election. So that, you know, the difficulty there is that we really don't know the size of their footprint until the election's already long gone and people are already looking to the next cycle. And so that makes things especially difficult.
And we could change the way in which we make these expenditures transparent. There isn't anything that restrains government from requiring that that we know more about this. Is that right?
Yes, I would say to a certain extent. And I think the difficulty here of broad-based campaign finance reform is that the Supreme Court has taken a position on First Amendment that is exceptionally broad, especially because they're very loath to do anything that would restrict what they consider to be anonymous political speech. That this, that, you know, capping spending, for example, or requiring the disclosure of this chills that speech. And even a recent Supreme Court decision from last year, Americans for Prosperity Foundation v. Bonta, essentially blocked the state of California from requiring nonprofits to disclose all their donors to the state because they felt that this would have a chilling effect on speech. So there's deep roots here, but there is certainly avenues where the state or the federal government could require at least some more disclosure. So we could at least see the scope of spending and how our politicians may be benefiting from it.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to continue talking with Simon Schuster of MLive about all the money sloshing around in campaigns in advance of next week's primary elections. We're going to get to you, the listeners, on the phones and on social media. Craig in Southfield, Max in Allen Park, Ed in Detroit. You're up first. You want to join them? 313-577-1019 is the number here. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today.
WDET is your place for open dialogue.
The music you love.
Real news and in-depth analysis.
And cultural experiences. The sound of Detroit.
101.9 WDET is your public radio station.
Six days left until the August 2nd primary here in Michigan, and we are talking with Simon Schuster of MLive about all the money that is flowing into campaigns and creating all these ads that you see on television and hear on the radio, the flyers and things that are crowding your mailbox. We're talking about what that money means. It is growing in politics, and especially in local politics. Some of it, we can't actually see who is responsible for it, who's trying to influence our votes and our public officials. Should we be changing the way that we think about this? Should there be limits on the way that people are able to raise money? Harsher limits? Should there be more transparency that attends the way that they collect and spend money on their own behalf? We want to hear from you during this conversation, especially. Give us a sense of what you make of the ads that you're seeing and hearing on the airwaves, the ads that you're seeing in your mailbox. Are they making you decide? Are they helping you to decide who you're going to vote for next Tuesday? Are they the way that you get information about campaigns and candidates? Or are you annoyed by all of this information and you're suspect of the people who are creating it and maybe the motives behind it? As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to the WDET Facebook page and put comments there, or you can go to Twitter, hashtag Detroit Today. We'll work into the conversation. Let's start today with Craig in Southfield.
Hey, good morning.
Hey, Craig.
Thanks for taking my call. Simon, thanks for being on. So I'll get right to the point. So there's this one ad in particular that keeps running, and it goes, technology is under attack. Tell your congressman to not vote for this. Who's behind that ad? Because it gives no details as to what their purpose is. It's just vague, general information, and it runs constantly. At least 9 times a day that ad runs. Who's behind that ad?
Craig, I love that you called and asked about a specific ad. I have not seen that one, I don't think. But I like your question because it really highlights the, I think, the darkness that voters often have to wander around in when they see these ads or hear them or get them in their mailbox. Again, who is behind these messages, and how do you find out? I think is one of the questions that occurs to everybody. All right, so Simon, can we help Greg out here? Have you seen this ad, and do you know who's responsible for it?
So I haven't personally seen this ad, but I think that this really sort of points to one of the hallmarks of dark money, which is that this is not necessarily so much for voters. Well, it can be, and it can influence elections to an extent. I think what this really underscores is that when you look at these ads and you see these groups, issue advocacy really is about telling people to do something. It's not about telling people who to vote for. But you often will hear, tell this congressman to vote, no on HB 2561. And the thing is, congressional staff and campaigns are very aware of this ad spending, and they feel the pressure that is going on from these ads because it might cast them in a negative light. The same way they might be rewarded because these ads are, touting their positions on a bill that these individuals might care about. Now, there is a distinction here because it might have an opaquely named group, but this might be a super PAC that's registered with the Federal Election Commission. And if it is, you can go on to FEC.gov, look up the name of it, and look into its funders. So while super PACs can spend unlimited amounts of money without coordinating with campaigns, they do have to disclose their donors. That said, those donors could exclusively be dark money organizations. And with a randomly named organization that sounds very obscure, your trail may end there. But if it is just the dark money organization spending the money directly, then you really don't have a lot of recourse. You might have to wait a year and then look up their nonprofit disclosure documents. And even there, you're not going to see who the donors are.
And frequently, we see this kind of ad sort of created around a candidate as opposed to an issue. I mean, you talked about ads that say, tell this congressperson to vote yes or no on this thing. But this time of year, what we see are ads that aren't for a particular candidate. They're against another candidate, and they're not coming from the campaign of an opponent. They come from, again, just it's unclear exactly who it is. And it seems to me that that's even more problematic, because here you're talking about essentially trying to influence an election, but not really saying where that influence is coming from. And of course, the veracity in these ads is always quite questionable. I mean, they are attack ads, and by definition, I think then they take some liberty. But some of them just, really bend the truth quite a bit. And I think that's the more common ad that we see, and it seems to me slightly more problematic.
Yeah, I think that there's sort of two things here. One is that while these are, arguably bad for our democracy, it's great for campaigns, because voters generally don't like seeing a candidate sort of get down and dirty and sort of say really negative and nasty things about their opponent. So they have these dark money organizations, super PACs and nonprofits that can really, do that. They can sling mud and get nasty for them while they're allowed to run a really positive campaign. I think the other part here, too, is that oftentimes you see PACs that are, as you said, not, that have a specific purpose, but aren't, speaking about what they care about at all, because they really just want an electoral outcome. That's really what's important to them. And it's not so much about, fighting for the issue. They want to change the outcome of the election. They don't want to necessarily speak too much about the single issue they care about, because that may not be what resonates best with voters.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, Craig, I really appreciate the call, and I wish you some luck trying to go to some of the resources that Simon pointed out to try to figure out where that ad comes from. I have not seen it, and Simon has not seen it, but I can tell it's getting on your nerves. I want to read a couple of social media comments. Susan on Twitter says, is too much the problem, or is it the source, especially from a handful of donors who are not disclosed? Anthony on Twitter says, Blue Cross, Blue Shield money figures really heavily into Michigan politics. That is Absolutely true. And when you look through campaign finance records, you do see our largest insurer in the state in a lot of campaigns and on a lot of issues. Michael on Twitter says, this might come up later in discussion, but can the guest talk more about how long super PACs have been around and why they're used? Simon, we've been kind of brushing up against that issue during the conversation. What's the answer to Michael's question?
Right. So, you know, independent expenditure committees, which is kind of what super PACs are not necessarily new to politics. Soft money advertising, which is that issue advocacy, is not something that's new to politics either. What sort of Citizens United changed is the sources that it can come from, that it can be from corporate sources, and they can spend enormous amounts of money. And you see sort of the echoes of this in our politics. In the most recent Supreme Court election in 2020, for example, the candidates themselves, the two Democratic Party nominated candidates who ultimately didn't really spend too much of their own campaign dollars on this election. Instead, there was a super PAC, Justice for All, which was a PAC that was sponsored by Michigan Justice Association, formerly the Trial Lawyers. And when you look at the campaign finance records of that organization, it's largely just law firms. And it's because these firms can now spend money under Citizens United and the subsequent changes to Michigan law, that was enabled to be possible. And so I think that while, you know, there's no longer caps on spending for some of these committees, it's not necessarily just corporations, but rather ultra wealthy individuals that have really benefited the most from these changes.
Again, Craig, thanks very much for the call. Also, some information for you, Craig. Our engineer, Matt, says that ad is about American Innovation and the Choice Online Act. He says Amazon is behind the ad, and the law that they're talking about there concerns antitrust. So I think that's a pretty interesting tidbit of information as well. Let's go back to the phones. Max in Allen Park, what's on your mind?
Well, good morning, guys. You know, having worked in politics for like a long time, and some people know that, some people don't, but I've seen how money raising, fundraising is so time consuming for elected officials. I mean, like call time is a very commonly bantered around term, and it's about raising money. I wish we could be more like the British or like Canadians that have a parliamentary system where everything is publicly financed, because disclosure under our current system, where there is no limit on money, is not enough.
Yeah. Max, I think that's a really important perspective to add to the conversation, that in other countries, they do this differently. And I think we tend to believe that our version of the democratic system is you know, the best. We also tend to think that it's the model for everybody else's. But on this count in particular, it's not. There are huge differences in other countries about the ways in which people are allowed to campaign, raise money, spend money, and things like that. Now, the big difference, I think, is the First Amendment to our Constitution, which really does say that political speech in particular is free and cannot be abridged in any way. And the idea of course, being free to petition for a redress of grievances also is one of the five freedoms protected by the First Amendment, has a lot to do with political activity. And so I think we tell ourselves that those things make us unable to change the system in a way that would be substantive or would make it look more like other countries. I'm not sure that I absolutely agree with it, but it certainly is the explanation that we're given, Simon Schuster, over and over again.
Right. And, you know, I think that it's important to note that there's been a couple of efforts to sort of level the playing field here, not necessarily stifle, you know, what the Supreme Court has deemed political speech, but sort of place smaller dollars donors on a more equal playing field. Because, you know, if this money and advertising is political speech, than a billionaire who donates $1 million to a super PAC has a lot more speech than, you know, your average person who's maybe working on minimum wage, right? And so New York City, for example, has tried to do a public matching funds program where if you give less than $250 to a candidate, they can apply to have that matched. I believe it's either 6 or 8 to 1. And so that money sort of has a much greater impact than it would otherwise. And similar in Seattle, every voter is given democracy vouchers, which then they can hand to the candidate of their choice. These are difficult programs to administer and at times costly, but it does sort of create a bit more, I guess you could say, equity in these elections. But these are very new programs and they haven't necessarily been refined yet. These are very much experiments.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones here. Frank in Livonia, what's on your mind?
Hey, good morning, Stephen.
Hey, Frank.
I remember we talked about this when Barbara McQuaid was on some time ago, and I'm thinking I'm going to start a political party that will be the fundraising, so it'd be like a clearinghouse, and it would be contractually bound to the candidates that are running under that political party, that they would be, you know, that money would be dispersed per vote on an equal basis. And it would create a firewall from that direct contact between the, you know, the donors and the candidate. And it wouldn't run into any, First Amendment things because, this is a contract between two parties, you know, the party itself and I guess the candidate. And I've run for office here in Livonia for state rep and for school board and city council and never was successful. And it was kind of like a boutique operation, I guess I would call it. And I really found out that, you know what, if you want to be a candidate, you must toe that party line. You can see that with Trump and the Republicans. And it's the same exact, because I ran as more of a Democrat then. But it is the exact same, thing in the Democrat Party. You will not get any support at all from the Democrats if you don't toe the different union line and the pro-choice line and, all these different types of things, no matter how you feel about it.
Frank, that's an interesting observation. I'm really glad you called and shared it. Simon, what's your reaction to what Frank's saying here?
I think that, while it's a sort of a noble aspiration, right, this sort of touches on one of the biggest difficulties in the American system for folks who want to reform how we do campaign finance is that when you look at our state house elections in the last, in 2020, the biggest source of dark money in these elections were the state parties themselves. They spent, I think, combined about $5 million in a $40 million election out of dark money accounts, so-called administrative accounts, to boost their candidates. And this is in large part because even if you want to reform the campaign finance system, right, the argument that's used over and over is that, well, you're not going to reform anything if you don't get elected. And so this sort of two-year election cycle, that churn of candidates over and over, the fundraising does not stop. And they're not, and I don't think either party is interested in unilaterally disarming themselves when this money is so integral to their electoral hopes.
Yeah. Okay, let's quickly go to Ed in Detroit. Ed, welcome to the show.
Morning. Great show as usual, Steve.
Thank you.
The reason I called, okay, we've got freedom of speech and everybody's kind of used to getting, political mail during this season, but I've been getting campaign texts on my phone. Okay, this has never happened before. And the thing is, how much are they spending to get my phone number? And from whom? I never gave them my number. It's a bit much, and it's intrusive. So, and I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead and finish, Ed.
No, it's basically, what avenue you already have, TV and everything. The best way, I think, of putting your point across is to have a debate with all the candidates, what they stand for and what they want to do.
Yeah. Ed, I'm really glad you called. I have to say, I am getting those texts as well, and I have the same question that you do, which is, how did they get my number? I don't remember giving my number to anybody saying, hey, text me about your campaign. Often it's for candidates I haven't heard of in other states. It's about issues that I can't vote on. Simon, fill us in on this part of campaign spending and things like that, and the idea that people should maybe be able to opt out of all the information that's out there.
I think that this is a great point to touch on because with our political system becoming more and more professionalized, I mean, I think it's fair to say it's already very professionalized. Data is king. All of the tools that are brought to bear on marketing, getting you to buy a product, are very much brought to bear now on political advertising. And what happens is that micro-targeting is increasingly important. The idea is that the ads that you run through on your social media feed, those political advertisements that you see on your Facebook news feed are as tailored to you as the ads for certain products that you can buy. I was speaking to a consultant just yesterday who was saying, I'm not going to be targeting someone for an ad until I know, you know, information like whether they own a home, how much their mortgage payment is, what professional associations they may belong to. So this data is really, really crucial for these campaigns because it enables them to spend money very efficiently and figure out what kind of messages they can use to best persuade voters. Even though, you know, a certain topic may be not a big part of someone's policy platform, not a big part of their agenda, you will see that featured centrally in an ad because they have data that illustrates this is something that I can use to push voters in my direction.
Yeah. Okay. Simon Schuster, investigative reporter for MLive. It was really great to have you here to help us sort through all of the money that is flowing into campaigns ahead of the August 2nd primary next week. Thanks so much for joining us here on Detroit Today.
Oh, thank you, Stephen. Always a pleasure to talk campaign finance.
We're going to take another quick break, and when we come back, we're going to have a little fun talking about changes in college football. The Big Ten expanding again, and for a while now, players have been able to make money off their names and likenesses. Are these changes making college football more exciting and better, or are they ruining the sport for fans? We're going to talk with Sean Windsor, a columnist and sports feature writer at the Detroit Free Press, as well as Braylon Edwards, who played football just up the road at the University of Michigan. Stay tuned for more Detroit Today.